Beloved MTV VJ, music exec, and radio personality Matt Pinfield has spent almost four decades in front of and behind the mic. He signed bands, interviewed Beatles, and had songs written about him. But now, he's having a different conversation. He's talking with friends and supporters across the entertainment industry about their journey and how he's found his voice again, being open about his recovery. This is Sound, Sobriety, and Success.
I love this guy. There's no question about it. He is the Grammy-winning Rock and Roll Hall of Famer who's been the driving force behind Guns N' Roses, The Cult, Velvet Revolver, and many others, and most recently partnering with Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top on his latest, and author of the new memoir, Double Talk and Jive, True Rock and Roll Stories. I'd like to welcome the great Matt Sorum. Matt, how are you, buddy?
Wow, what an intro.
What's up, my brother?
I don't know how to follow that one up. Yeah, so, damn, I'm great. I got a hat on because I thought I would dress up for you. I got a shirt on, no pants. You know what I mean? Here I am.
And you're comfortable because you're home, which is a really cool thing.
That's right.
And, you know, first and foremost, I got to congratulate you on the beautiful baby girl. I mean, the photos of her are amazing. And tell me how that's been for you, right? Because, I mean, I know... It's like the old days of not much sleep at night. So you got to tell me about that.
Well, let me tell you something. I'm up at 6, but I used to stay up till 6. Now I'm up at 6. I'm like, oh my God, like to be able to even, you know, I think about people having kids and they always say, you're never going to sleep again. And I'm like, well, they're right.
Yeah. Well, at least in the beginning, you know what I mean? Every kid is different. Because I had a daughter who started sleeping through the night in 3 months, and another one, it took 3 years.
We got her sleeping through the night. We're just making the transition to the crib because I did not want to let go of her. She was in a little thing called the Schnoo, one of the greatest inventions I've ever seen. Have you seen this thing? When they cry, it rocks them, and kids love white noise sound.
Yes.
Because supposedly it's the sound they hear when they're in the womb. And it's like, and I have that going. But this thing rocked her to sleep, but now she's growing out of it. And the first couple nights she went in there into her big crib, I'm sleeping at the foot of the thing, right? Like making, I'm down there, like the foot of the, on the floor.
Yeah.
And now... She's in there by herself, and we got a camera and all that stuff. And last night we didn't sleep much, but it takes them a minute to acclimate to the bigger space, you know, where they are. And so last couple of nights, not a lot of sleep, but I love it. She's amazing. We named her Lou Ellington, and people go, why Lou Ellington? And I'm like, well, just, you know how it is when you name your daughter, the name just kind of comes to you.
Yes.
It kind of like appears. And Lou, we just loved the sound of it. Like, you know, and then Ellington was this, I don't know, it came out of nowhere. Like Lou Ellington was like, people say, is that Duke Ellington, the famous jazz musician? And I'm like, well, okay. And Lou just had a nice ring to it. And so it's Lou Ellington Sorum is her name.
Yeah, it's a great name, man. I love that. It's really cool. You know, my oldest daughter, her name is pretty, you know, it's got a lot of commonality to it. Of course, she's one of a kind and total individual and amazing. Jessica Lynn Pinfield. I was thinking of naming her Kaylee because I think Marillion had a single out in like 86 called Kaylee, and she was, you know, part Irish. So I was thinking, all right, that might be good. And now I'm glad she's Jessica.
Well,
she's
just Jess. That's a little off center. Like everyone's naming their kids like Jagger and, you know, I'm like, oh. I mean, no disrespect to people that have a kid named Jagger, because we all love Jagger, but I have a dog named Bowie, okay? I named my dog Bowie, right? But the rock and roll Dylan, you know, which I love the name Dylan. But there's a lot of like similarities between that. So I would consider my baby's name a jazz kind of flavor.
It's cool. Yeah, and then, you know, my second daughter was named Maya Penelope Pinfield. So Penelope was like... Remember Penelope Pit Stop and Penelope's Fair? So we just like the way it rang.
I love Maya Penelope. It's not used enough. It's like Lou. Yeah. Lou was a really cool name back in the 50s and 60s. Obviously, women were like Mary Lou, Betty Lou, you know, all those
Peggy
kinds
Sue.
Of things.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Right.
Peggy Sue. So we kind of took from that. And anyway, there it is.
It's great. Well, she's beautiful. I mean, the photos that I've seen, you know, you pass between.
Well, but that's the blessing. We just look at her every day and we, you know, it wasn't like the easiest birth for my wife. We went through some stuff and it was tough for her. But now we're just every day we're like, oh, my God, look at that kid. Whoa. Unbelievable. Yeah. So it's a whole different life experience for me now. Like what we'll get into talking about the old days.
Yeah, we'll talk about them all. And why don't we start where you are now? Because I think it's amazing. After 40 years of living and working in and around L.A., you ended up moving out to the desert, to Palm Springs. Talk to me about moving there.
Yeah, well, you know, in and around all my band experiences, you know, obviously after Guns N' Roses broke up, there was like kind of a, you know, you have hills and valleys. In my career, I've had hills and valleys. I always think of like drummers like Lars Ulrich or Trey Cool who have been in the same band since day one, you know, and they've never had a hill or a valley. Maybe they had some emotional hills and valleys, but the band stayed together is what I'm saying. My career hasn't been that way. I'm in a band, then I'm not, and then I'm looking for another band. So in between Guns N' Roses and Velvet Revolver, there was quite a valley. In the book, I talk about it, but I go through, you know, a lot of emotional stuff, like what next? What am I going to do next? Probably similar to you, Matt, when you're doing radio stuff and then you got to move on to the next thing and looking for the next thing to do. In a way, for me, it's been very cool because it always keeps me hungry, if that makes sense. I remember when we got Velvet Revolver together, I had that rock and roll hunger again of being like a young kid coming to Hollywood. I wanted to prove myself again that I still could, you know, pull off a really great rock band, which I feel that we did. And then after Velvet Revolver, in around 2008 or 9 when we broke up, that was when things got a little bit like, uh-oh, okay, I think I don't know if I got another band in me. You know, like I'd done the Cult, Guns N' Roses, Velvet Revolver. I got like, you know, 3 really big bands. I did a short stint with Motorhead, which was just out of the blue, but that wasn't a member of the group. I just sat in. And then I formed my own thing called Kings of Chaos, which has just been like a bucket list fun thing for me to do. And at the same time, I was like, well, I don't really need to live in Hollywood anymore. And it kind of became like, I used to worry about leaving Hollywood because it was like, I used to say out of sight, out of mind, meaning if I wasn't on the scene, if I wasn't around the other musicians, they'd forget about me or something, you know? So there was like this kind of little bit of a fear, deep fear that if I left the city, that the city would leave me and I wouldn't be included. Well, that all changed when the internet came and we could communicate virtually. And so I married my wife, Ace, out here in Palm Springs. And I wrote my second solo album out here. And I always kind of thought about the folklore of the desert, you know, Graham Parsons, Keith Richards coming out here, Donovan, the folk singer, all these artists that gravitated towards the desert to create music. So I came out here to write an album and I fell in love with it. And instantly I felt the vibe. And it was this calming effect because in the city, it was always intense, like, you know, and in Hollywood, you have to kind of get, you have to be a hustler. If you're not hustling, you're not like, you know, you're not doing your bit. You're not like competing with the other shit that's going on. You're not out there trying to find the next thing. But in the desert, I just slowed down. It was just like, and I found things were still happening and happening almost in a better way because I wasn't trying to push a square peg through a round hole. That makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, so, it makes a lot of sense.
I called my wife and I said, honey, we got to get married out here because we were going to get married in Mexico. And we got married in this really cool old hotel called the Colony Palms, built in the 20s. And gangsters used to go there. They used to drive through from Vegas and they'd stop in Palm Springs. And there was this speakeasy. So it was this killer spot, vibey. And we got married there. And we had these bicycles that we took from the hotel. And we were riding around. I said, hey, let's go back towards that mountain. And we started riding back towards the San Jacinto Mountain. crest that goes through all of Palm Springs. And we came into this little neighborhood called Vista Las Palmas. And there's this really cool old part of Palm Springs called Old Las Palmas. And that's where Kirk Douglas lived and Elizabeth Taylor and the great drummer Buddy Rich lived there and Dean Martin and all these cool guys, right? And we drive through and we're on our bikes and I'm like, oh my God, this is incredible. It was like driving onto a set of Mad Men. All the houses are 1960s, right? It, full on, like every house, every third house is the same, but bitchin', like built by an architect named Charles Dubois. And what we ended up doing was we just got online and rented a house right away. And I remember we stayed out here for three and a half, four years. And we kept our house in L.A. But we ended up being here 8-9 months a year and then going back to L.A. because we felt like we had to. And then we're like, let's go back. You know, so
yeah.
When the baby came and the pandemic hit, we were out here full stop because the city was a mess. Like the homeless thing was going really bad with what's happening in L.A. And there was a lot of crime and we're just like, let's get the hell out of here. And the baby came when we sold our house in L.A. and now we're permanent residents of Palm Springs and we love it.
That's amazing. It is great out there. That bike ride you guys are talking about, I did that when I was out there convention.
You come out here. I'm going to take you on a tour of my 62 Galaxy. We could have a whole other show. Matt do Palm Springs. I'm going to ride you around in my car, my convertible. I'm going to take you through a neighborhood where John F. Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe met, Jack Benny, Liberace, and all these cats. And there's a vibe. And now with the pandemic, a lot of people are gravitating here because I think the city feel is different. Now, virtual has become an everyday thing. You know, here we are talking to each other. It's more user-friendly. Like everyone's got, it's not just a business, a tool. So, you know, home prices have driven up because of the pandemic because people are spending more time at home. And so we're just really happy we're here. But mainly the desert has given us a real sense of calm. The spiritual vibe around here is deep because this is native country. This is Agua Caliente Chula tribe country. This is native soil. You know, the native Indians that live here and still live here, all the land here has got that vibe to it. So we love it.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful out there. It's amazing. Hey, before ILA, though, you grew up in Orange County. Can you talk to me about what your upbringing was like and what, talk to me about those early days and discovering pop, rock and roll, soul.
Well, luckily I had two older brothers. You know, my middle brother, Mark, was the rock and roll guy. And in my book, it describes getting my first 45 record, A Hard Day's Night, you know, in the mid-60s. And of course, the family would watch the Ed Sullivan Show, which was, you know, Sunday night, Ed Sullivan. We'd sit around the TV. It was the variety show. Now, I was a little bit too young to see the first time the Beatles went on. But I saw, I believe, the third time the Beatles performed on Ed Sullivan was in 1965. I was 5 years old. And they played a song called I Feel Fine. And I was old enough to be able to sort of look at the TV and go, wow, that's what I want to do. It was like when you're a kid and you're like, I want to be a fireman. You see a fire truck or something, and you go, I want to do that. Or a train would go by and you go, I'm going to be a conductor. Or a plane, I want to be a pilot. I'm like, I want to be Ringo.
You can call a friend. I mean, you've known him for a long time.
Well, and you and me have been lucky enough to bump elbows with Ringo. But I said to him one time, I said, Ringo, you're the reason I'm a drummer. And his reply was, I hear that all the time. And then I said to him, well, you're the best. Ringo said, you're the best. I'm the greatest.
I love him. You know, it's funny when we run into him and meet up with him, it's always funny because He's a funny guy. And then, you know, like, you don't necessarily ask him outright about Beatles stories because it's kind of a nut. But he always will tell you one. You know, like, it'll just come out. He'll start talking about
something. I mean, did you watch the Get Back thing yet?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was.
Isn't it incredible? Watching him be this mediator of these characters, right?
Yes.
His sense of calm through those sessions was pretty amazing. And I thought about my career and how I didn't always act that way. In retrospect, if I had to change anything. With the Cult, I sat on the drum stool and I kept my mouth pretty much shut. You know, it was Ian and Billy's band. They were the leaders, and that was okay. It was like, I'm here to lay down a groove. I didn't have to, you know, go, hey, you guys, I think we should change the chorus. You know, I never said that. You know, I was like laying it down. Now, Guns N' Roses came along. You know, me and Slash and Duff and Izzy were musically collaborating. It was very open. It was very willing to try anything. The experimentation between the band members, obviously I was a new guy to the band, so it took a different feel, and the Use Your Illusions album turned a major corner with when it came to experimenting with pianos and orchestration. And we got into, like, you know, different grooves from the Appetite record. But we, in those days, Axl felt like we had to. And we wanted to represent a band that was moving forward, much like when the Stones played country music, or they went after reggae, or they, you know, they experimented. They didn't just play the same rock and roll all the time. You know, they played ballads with Angie, and we thought that way. We were like, what can we do to go to the next level? And so when we made those records, we were really open. When Axl came in with the piano, I remember going, whoa, there's a piano. And we were listening to Elton John. We were listening to, you know, all this music that I never expected to be a part of Guns N' Roses. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Guns N' Roses was kind of like based in like AC/DC and Aerosmith and, you know, Nazareth and punk rock and the Pistols. And then along came this sort of epic version of GNR with the beautiful piano ballads that Axl brought to the table. And early fans of Appetite were like, whoa, well, that's like, you know, it wasn't AC/DC making the same kind of records every time. It was, you know, but at the same time, my point is, there was a really open vibe to the band. And I could say stuff to the other guys like, hey, I remember we were playing a song called Locomotive. And I go, hey, what do you think about if we go to the chorus there instead? And they go, yeah, cool. It was like that.
Yeah.
It was never like, no, man, I don't think so. Let's try it. We would try shit. And that was what made it great. And when Velvet Revolver came along, maybe I had a little bit more of a voice because I was an original member. And I started writing songs and bringing songs because Guns N' Roses, I didn't like walk in and have a song. Like Slash had riffs, Duff had riffs, Axl had stuff, you know. So I was just like more of an arrangement kind of guy, throwing ideas out. But with Velvet Revolver, I'm like, shit, man, I'm going to bring in some material.
Yeah.
And I brought in the first song I wrote, Set Me Free, on guitar. And I remember standing in front of Slash playing it going, fuck, I can't believe I'm playing guitar in front of Slash. He goes, oh, that's a pretty cool riff, man. And Scott sang on it. And then, you know, we got a record deal. And so that made me feel really good. It gave me a lot of confidence about my songwriting too.
Yeah. So. Which is amazing when you think about it. Now, I got to talk about going back in the book. You know, you mentioned the $50 Rambler that you moved to LA in. And what was it like when you got there? Because, you know, you and I have talked about this over the years. But for people that are listening, hearing it for the first time, coming there as a drummer, I mean, there's just so many cool things you were involved with. But what was it like in the very beginning?
Well, you did ask me a question about my growing up, and I kind of veered off on it like I usually do. But I grew up in Orange County, you know, and here I was my brothers were into music, but then, you know, late 60s, you know, Hendrix came along, and then the early 70s, I still look at it as the greatest period of music probably in the history, right? There was Sly and the Family Stone, there was Earth, Wind, and Fire, there was Sabbath, Deep Purple, you know, there was so many different, Joni Mitchell, I loved her, I remember loving her as a kid. And I remember my brothers turning me on to records and my friends, and we were listening to music, and here we were in Orange County. But the big picture was getting to Hollywood. So now I started a band in high school called Prophecy. And there was this great guitar player named Jeff Harris. And he was an African-American guy. And he played killer, kind of Hendrix-y, talking mid-70s. So we started tooling up to Hollywood. And I was like 14. And we'd play this club called Gazzari's Crazy Horse West. It's on the Sunset Strip. And he used to have four stages there. And it's all in the book. And I remember sneaking through the back door. He had an all ages night. And early version of Van Halen would play their Mammoth before they got signed down at the Whiskey in 78. I told Michael Anthony the story, but he didn't join until a little bit later. And so as soon as I graduated high school in 78, I bought this $40 Rambler station wagon. I actually bought it for a quarter ounce of weed. So it was less than $40.
Yeah, so you traded the weed for it?
I traded the weed for this car that was a rust green Rambler.
Yeah.
And it was killer. It had no reverse, though. I used to have to push it in reverse. And I went out and I dropped like $250 on a Power Play 8-track player.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Oh, yeah, those 8-tracks. I mean, listen, you spent more money on the stereo system than you did the car.
Way more, way more. And I remember I had Fog Hat on 8-track. Remember Fog Hat?
Which album? Was it Fool for the City or Rock and Roll Outlaws?
Fool for the City!
Yeah, it's great.
And UFO.
Yeah.
Lights Out in London.
Oh, boy, I loved Lights Out. I saw that tour when I was...
I had Humble Pie. Doctor, please. Oh, that's Humble. That's a UFO.
Yeah, but also Humble Pie smoking.
I don't need no doctor.
Yeah, so good.
I saw fucking Humble Pie with Steve Marriott.
30 days in the hole, man.
30 days in
hot and nasty.
We'll go into that later. So I drive my Rambler up to Hollywood. My buddy was a pot dealer. So I'm like, this is how I'm going to live in Hollywood. I'm going to get 2 pounds of Mexican Sensi, and I'm going to sell it to be able to pay my rent to eat. Here I am in this Rambler tooling up to Hollywood. I got my pot. I move in with two other drummers in Glendale. And we started going into Hollywood every night. I'd tool over the Barham Drive there. Past Ford's Lawn.
Barham Boulevard, yep, right?
Yeah. And then dropped down into the city, and it was just like, oh my God. Just the feeling and the buzz that I got every time I drove down Sunset Boulevard in the early 70s, late 70s. 79, I moved there, 1979. And talks about it in the club days of like the Central. Used to hang out there. There was a Tuesday night jam night. And
that was that period of the Knack 2020, the Plimsolls, right? All that stuff.
So 79 was still kind of coming out of that. The stuff that was coming, the new wave stuff was coming early 80s, 1980. Yeah. So the Whiskey was starting to play punk bands from Orange County, like Fear, Dead Kennedys from the Bay Area. I remember going, whoa, what's that? You know, the Pistols were already out, the Ramones and that stuff. But, you know, that wasn't really my thing. I considered myself a muso a little bit. I was like, I kind of was into like Genesis and, you know.
Yeah, prog stuff. Yeah.
King Crimson and, you know, Deep Purple was a progressive band, in my opinion, a progressive rock band with a lot of chops.
Yeah, so absolutely.
I was a guy that prided myself on having a lot of chops. And so I got my first gig in that Central Club with a guitarist named Greg Wright. great left-handed guitar player that I toured all over the South with. That's in the book. I talk about my first big tour, like in a van.
Yeah.
Like 19. Great. You know, I could drink and just eat whatever I wanted, get up and do it all over again the next day. You know?
Amazing when you think about it. Now, you were called Matt the Mercenary when you moved to L.A., right? Was there like a story behind that, that it was like, because you had to make a living, right? So people wanted to rehearse, they had to pay you $25. Was that what that was?
I can't blame you
because, I mean, hey, man, you're like, hey, especially because you know how a lot of times people don't pay you, as you know, well, we've been there, right?
I started getting known for being a very professional guy.
Yeah.
And they could count on me. And typically, drummers never had a very good rap for being, you know, professional. So
yeah, I mean, look at some of our look at Keith Moon, some of our heroes.
Though I idolized him and John Bonham, you know. But yeah. My goal was to never have to work a real job. I think I had two real jobs in my life. I worked at a gas station, and that was when you could pay after, and I gave away free gas to all the pretty girls.
And then, that's amazing. I love that story.
I'll get your windows and see you next time. You know,
yeah.
I got fired because there was so much money missing from the till, you know.
Yeah.
Then I worked
at
a glass shop, and I was carrying like a big piece of glass. And I remember going, I can't do this job. I need my hands. You know, I was like thinking I'm going to cut off my fingers. That's not going to work. So I quit. And then I worked at a restaurant for a minute. And I remember I was in there cooking fries and greasy burgers, and I'm breaking out with, you know, pimples, and I'm like, this isn't gonna work. I can't look like this. I can't have it.
Yeah.
So yeah. I quit, and then my goal was, I'm never gonna work a real job again. So I would say, well, I'm gonna play in as many bands as I can. And at one time, the most amount of bands I was ever in at the same time was 9 or 10. I think I had 9 or 10 bands, and I was making $20, $25 a rehearsal. $50 to $75 a gig was my pay rate. And
that's great. And it went far back then. It went far when you and I.
Oh my God, I had a top 40 gig that I played 5 nights a week. I made $250 a week. And I played 5 sets a night. So I was playing, I would start playing at 7:30 and we'd be done at 2. And I remember in those days, I drank like kamikaze shots. And so I said to the band, I said, look, if we're going to drink and play, let's barter with the audience. Let's make them buy us shots. If you want to play Cocaine by Eric Clapton, that's a round of shots, right? If you want to hear Working for the Weekend by Loverboy, that's a round of shots. If you want to hear Freebird, that's 3 rounds of shots.
Yeah, because, hey, you got to make up for that time. We're doing the 11-minute live version.
So, you know what I mean? The songs that we didn't want to play, we just said to the audience, if you want to hear Freebird, it's 3 rounds of shots for the band. They go, yeah, Freebird. And so we could drink for free and make our $50. And I came up with that myself because I was spending money at the bar. I'm like, shit, I'm only making $20 here. I'm spending the rest on booze. So, yeah, it was a good time. So I did all that. And I was literally playing at Disneyland. It was, and this is a lot of history at Disneyland. Josh Freese, the great drummer that we know from Sting, Devo, he's played with a great band with Maynard Keenan, Perfect Circle.
Yeah.
Josh was, his dad booked Disneyland, Stan Freese. Yeah. Josh was a drummer on one of the stages when he was 15. I remember meeting him. And Greg Bissonette played on another stage. And I was in a band called Donna and the Kids. And that girl, Donna, went on to be a background singer for Motley Crue. We were all looking for the big break.
Yeah.
But Disneyland paid $150 a night to play there, so we all played there because that was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
And I got the call from my buddy that the Cult was looking for a drummer. And he said, man, you should go audition. And there's a guy named Terry Nails, and Pat Torpey was the drummer, a friend of mine that called me as well, who ended up going on to play with a band called Mr. Big and since left the planet, but he was a great friend and great drummer. And I said, oh, really? The Cult. So I got all their albums. You know, I got the Love record. I even went back and got Sonic Death Cult just in case they asked for it. Southern Death Cult.
Yeah.
And then they had Southern Death Cult, Death Cult,
Time.
Death Cult.
Yeah.
So I got Love, the Electric album.
Yeah.
Which was produced by Rick Rubin. And I went in and my buddy had a studio in Burbank and I woodshedded. I just played them all. And I got the call to go down and audition with Billy and Jamie Stewart down at Mates Rehearsal Studios in North Hollywood. And I went over there and rehearsed, and Ian wasn't there. I walk in, and I had red drum kit. I had this big red drum kit that I'd gotten. And that's a whole other story. It's in the book about David Lee Roth. I auditioned for that. And Billy goes, "Do you have any black drums?" Before I'd even played, it was the wrong color drum kit.
Yeah, because they were looking for the dark goth. They wanted it to be black.
Yeah.
Didn't he say something about you got to do that before Ian gets here or something funny to that nature?
So I said, is the singer coming? And they said, no, he's in London. So I played and we jammed through a lot of stuff and everything went really well. And Billy said, you know, that sounded really great. We'll call you. And about 2 weeks went by. And I was really superstitious in those days. And you ever had this happen to you, Matt, where something's great is in the window, right? And you're like, yeah. Going, well, and you start telling people and then it goes away.
Yeah. As soon as you do, it's almost like clockwork.
So I didn't say shit. People were like, how did the cold audition go? I go, not sure. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. Or I'd be like, not say anything. Like, hey, I auditioned for the cold. I think I got it. I didn't do that. I was like, mom's the word. And then about 2 weeks later, I get the call. Hey, come back down. Ian's here. He wants to see you. Hear you play. And it was like Howard Kaufman's office. We're managing the cult in those days. And a guy named Jimmy Ayers. So I go down there and I'm in the studio and I'm playing and Ian walks through the door in full regalia. He's got the hat with the skull, sunglasses on, big medallion hanging from his. He looked cool. His hair was like. And he just looked at me like this, like very stern English kind of dry thing.
Yeah.
And he goes, Billy goes, let's play Love Removal or whatever we played. And Ian turned around to me and he said, you got the gig, but quit smiling so much.
That's what it was. That's the greatest.
So I used to be like this guy, like, yeah, you know?
Yeah.
That's when I started going like,
going, you know? Through your teeth. And it's
like,
so funny.
If people say, man, you've got a real, like, your facial expressions are really like kind of, I go, yeah, blame that on Ian Astbury.
That's such a great story. There's also, you know, like, let's talk too about how you discovered Tori Amos, because I mean, these stories are incredible. Was that at the Marriott Airport Hotel, right? Or was that
that was
LAX.
Yeah, that's right. So that was another top 40 gig in my sort of, so I would say from about the early 80s, I would get the periodic little tour like Greg Wright. I talk about that in the book. But then I had to just make a living. So I would take these top 40 gigs with bands that we would book up at places like the Marriott Airport Hotel. We would play this circuit called the Black Angus. It was a steakhouse, but all the bands played there. And we would play top 40. So we would do anything from Prince to Loverboy to, you know, whatever was on the radio at the time. And I had this band, and I remember walking out of the lounge where I was playing, and I saw this girl in the middle of the lobby of the hotel, sitting on the piano with a tip jar, and she was playing the song Bad Company by the band Bad Company.
Right.
Bad Company, I guess bad.
Yeah.
And I walked over to her and I went, who are you? And she was singing it in Tori's very interesting presentation. And at that time, it was sort of early 80s. I was kind of dabbling in a new wave. I'd cut my hair kind of, I don't want to say flock of seagulls, but I had like a pompadour, but a bit curly, almost Duran Duran-ish.
Or Stray Cats, right?
In those days, you had to look a certain way or you just didn't work. You know, heavy rock was kind of done for a minute in the early 80s, especially Hollywood. So I was into Kate Bush. I was into early Peter Gabriel when he left Genesis, the Salisbury Hill stuff. And I heard that in her. And I remember going, do you like Kate Bush? She's like, oh, yeah. So we got together and we formed a band. And I got the other musicians, Steve Caton, Brad Cobb, and we put a band together and we played all over town and we named the band Why Can't Tori Read? And we got signed to Atlantic Records by Jason Flom at the Lava label. But I remember that was my first sort of awakening to the music business because I never got called from Tori again. And there was never a phone call and they were making the record. And I went, what the hell? I finally got a hold of Tori and she said, they just signed me. They don't want the band. And I went, what? Yeah, they're signing me as a solo artist. And it was like heartbreaking because I'd spent 2 years with her developing the music. But as we all know, God's rejection is God's protection.
Yes, absolutely.
So it worked out in the end for me. But at the time, it was really disappointing. And I ended up going back into play on that record. And I talk about it in the book. It was when I first learned sort of how to negotiate for myself. I remember them calling, going, well, we tried some other drummers, but we don't think it's working. And Tori really wants you to play on the record. And I threw out some number. I said, kind of a pretty big number for me. I was like, more money I'd ever made in probably my entire career. I said, $10,000. Because I was not happy about it. So it was either, and they go, okay. And I'm like, well, I can buy a car now, you know?
Yeah.
I bought a little Datsun 280Z. I was like, I'm in the music business, man. And I made that record with Tori. And then I went on my way, went back to doing Top 40 and whatnot. And then a few years later, The Cult came along. And I look back in retrospect and I think, wow, what would have happened to me if I would have been the drummer in Tori Amos? I might never have turned that corner to The Cult, to GNR. You know, whatever door shuts, another one opens. And the door that opened for me was the right door, you know?
It really did. Yeah. Let's go to Guns N' Roses and how that all came down. To be in a situation, too, Matt, where you all of a sudden you're in the, really, arguably the biggest band in the world at that time, or one of the biggest bands in the world. Was it a case of be careful what you wish for, or was it one of the greatest things that ever happened? What was the experience like?
Well, at the time, I think, you know, I luckily had the precursor with The Cult because the reason I got in the band was Lars Ulrich. Lars had my phone number and I was living at my mom's house because when I finished The Cult tour, I didn't have any place to live. I was a vagabond. I had a suitcase and that was it. And Lars gave Slash my phone number. And Slash and Duff had come to see me play the very last night of the Sonic Temple tour. We were playing two nights at Universal Amphitheater. And I remember seeing those guys pull in. And there's a great story in the book about what they looked like when they pulled in. Okay. And I go, look at those guys, man. They look like fun.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, oh, I like those guys. They're cool. Definitely were swagger. They had a lot of swagger. And lo and behold, they liked what they saw. And at that time, The Cult was on fire. We were a strong rock unit. And Firewoman was a big hit. And Sonic Temple album was at the top of its heap. And we were doing really well. I think we were in the top 10. That record went top 10.
Yeah.
Went platinum. So we were kicking ass. And the tour came to an end and things got quiet. And I got called from Slash at my mom's house, which is funny. And I went up to LA and I started playing with them. And the idea initially was that I was going to just record the record and Stephen was going to come back because he was struggling with his addiction and everything. No, everybody knows that story. And I ended up getting asked to join the group. I had to go tell the cult I was leaving, which was absolutely horrible. I remember taking Billy Duffy to lunch and telling him over lunch.
And he, How did they take it?
A typical Billy Duffy fashion, he said, I guess you're buying lunch then.
Which is so great.
The one regret I have is not telling Ian face to face. I told Billy, but I didn't meet with Ian. Because me and Ian were like, we were drinking buddies on the road. We had a lot of fun together. There's a lot of great stories in the book about Ian. And we were, when I moved to England to join the cult, there was a lot of drinking going on. I remember going to my first pub and going, wow, I like this pub life. It was warm and cozy. And the drinks were in pint glasses. And they gave me a snake bite, which is half cider and half beer. And it just knocked me down. I drank about 3 or 4 of those babies and I was on my ass.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I liked cider. I liked it. And we did a lot of drinking. That band, we were a drinking band. We weren't a drugging band, even though I got into doing, I was doing, in the book, I do a lot of drugs earlier on in my life. But in the cult, we drank. And yeah. When I finally got into GNR, then the drugs were back.
Yeah.
But that was, at the time, it was right. It was the right thing to do. It was part of being a pirate on a pirate ship. You know, it was apropos. We were a rock and roll band, you know. Obviously, certain intake had to be enough to get you to rehearsal at 12 o'clock, you know.
Yeah.
Slash would always say that. Slash would say, look, if you party, I don't give a fuck how hard you party. If you can't make rehearsal at 12 noon, just slow down a little bit. And
yeah.
So we worked hard, but we played really hard too. I mean, we partied, and Slash was the kind of musical leader of the group. Axel was obviously the front man and the vocal leader and everything, but Slash kind of cracked the whip on the rest of us. If anybody got out of hand, I remember on tour one time, him coming over to the tour bus, and I was on a bit of a bender, a 3-day bender. He said,
"Yeah."
He said, "Matt, you got to take it down a notch." I'm like, I'm going to be great tonight. It's going to be a great show. Yeah. But he was that guy. He was like, it was like Keith Richards, you know. It was Keith Richards. I slept in a chandelier. I could still make the show. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
You're in a rock and roll band now. Don't fuck that up too. So
yeah,
it was great working with those guys. And, you know, we had a lot of fun together. And it was wild times, you know. And I look at GNR as sort of like the precursor of the rest of my life, or sort of it's opened up a lot of doors for me and other avenues in my life, other things that I do now. GNR is the marker. It's like when people hear that name, it's just there, you know?
Yeah.
Call it, they go, oh, I don't know. If you were lining people up and you ask them band names, right? Maybe out of 10 people, how many do you think would know the cult? 2? 3? Depends who they are, but I'm just saying in a general population, it'd be Velvet Revolver, about the same. Guns N' Roses, unanimous, you know?
Yeah.
Worldwide, too. It's like, you know, I'll talk to a guy, might be a Latino guy from Mexico City. Oh, my God, flips out. Brazilian flips out. Me and my wife went to Italy. You know, we walked in to get the hotel room, and the guy says, oh, my God, you met Sam. And put us in the presidential suite. I mean, it works out for me sometimes.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I was just going to get a regular room with 2 double beds. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot of
great things that have come with the moniker that I was in the group and got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and everything with them. And I've told them this before. I've said this in the press about them before, that it gives me great pride to know I was there to create these this musical legacy. And I'm where I'm supposed to be now. Palm Springs with my baby and my wife.
Which is great. Go back, obviously, it's amazing. The story, and it, something people will see in the book, too, was you were a drug smuggler at a very young age. And you and I have talked about this before, but it was – I love the fact that it was that fear of getting busted that made you make the move to take your drumming completely seriously, which was great. So tell me, but how did that happen? Because you were like 18 years old when you were doing the drug smuggling thing.
I tell people this, and I don't like to like look at it like it's a proud moment in my life because it was the 70s, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the 70s was a different time. And in Orange County, where I grew up, it was a hub for smuggling. Like Dana Point Harbor, most of the stuff that came up from Mexico came through that harbor. And I was just, all my friends were either selling pot. And then when the cocaine era came, which is the later 70s, everyone was like, hey, you can make more money, you know, hawking this stuff. And of course, I liked it too. I did the stuff. And in those days, cocaine tasted like bubblegum. It was exceptional. It was like, and I was young and I got offered to go to Hawaii to take this stuff to Hawaii and a couple $1,000 a trip. And there was no security like there is these days. You would just jump on an airplane. You'd go through, there was no metal detectors or anything. And I used to strap this stuff around my waist, would wear a dinner jacket and get on the airplane to Hawaii. I never touched the ship before I got on the plane. I was just always like square pegged. And I was making a living doing it. And it was adventurous and the adrenal glands were pumping. I mean, it was like, this shit was edgy and dangerous to the highest level.
Yeah.
And I just always liked pushing the envelope like that. And I did it later on in my life as well. But I remember my intuition kicked in one day and I thought, man, this is not going well and something's going to happen. And my intuition, I learned very early on in my life to listen to my intuition. My intuition told me that I needed to get out. So when I got out and I told the guy that I was working with, I'm going to split, he put another guy in my place and that guy got arrested and went to prison for 20 years.
Wow.
And we were going across the international lines. So, you know, it wasn't a large amount and thing, you know, compared to what you'd hear about or anything. So,
yeah.
I learned a lot from that experience, and luckily I got out and started to build a better life for myself in music, because I don't know what road I would have gone down if something would have happened to me in that respect. You know, going to prison, my life would be nothing. It would be, so I'm not proud of it, but it was part of my story, so I put it in the book because it's part of what happened, and it's kind of what got me out of that and really focusing on my music, you know?
Yes. And, you know, so much has happened since then. And I mean, it's incredible. Talk to me about your last days with Guns. I mean, you had an incredible run with those guys. When you guys broke up, that's in a situation like that. It's like we talked about, and you mentioned earlier while we were talking here about when a gig ends and you're like, well, what am I going to do next? You know? And we've learned to trust in a spiritual way. Because we've changed our lives.
After we toured Use Your Illusions, you know, there was quite a bit of time there where we were trying to come up with new material. I mean, in retrospect, I guess that would have been called really more of the sophomore effort. You know, typically a band makes that second record and they struggle just for the second record. But I don't know. I mean, we just weren't connecting. And I was just trying to be a team player and be there and everything. And it just never happened. And I remember I was starting to produce other bands. I produced Poe. So I built my own studio. So there was downtime in between when we were recording and working as GNR. Yeah. We created Neurotic Outsiders, me and Duff. Yeah. We made that record during GNR.
Yeah.
So before GNR broke up, Neurotic Outsiders came out, me and Steve Jones, and Duff and John Taylor from Duran Duran. We made a great record, in my opinion, for Maverick. And but we couldn't really pursue it because we were still in GNR. Then the Pistols got back together. And then I produced Poe, and that was, I had a hit on K-Rock. I had a top 10 hit as a producer.
Yeah, Angry Johnny, right?
Yeah.
I know. And yeah. I remember when Poe lived on a, didn't she live on a houseboat with Mike Inez from Alice in Chains?
That's right.
They were like together.
They were together.
I remember talking to Mike, and he's like, yeah, I'm dating Poe now, and I'm living on a houseboat with him.
You know, Mike would come.
We were all
studio.
Friends back then, you know. Like we're still friends with Mike, of course. But you know what I mean. Like everybody, we
Mike
all
would come
other.
To the studio, and make comments. I go, Mike, get out of here. Go talk to your band.
Yeah.
No, Mike. I love Mike. Mike's like a dear friend. We played in Slash the Snake Pit together.
Yeah.
That's cool. So I was producing Candlebox, the band Candlebox, and I built a really cool studio up in the Hollywood Hills, and I went to rehearsal and. Me and Axel got into an argument, and I ended up getting kicked to the curb. And I went home, and I remember the Candlebox guys were there, and I said, I think it's over. I'm out of GNR. And I remember it was a really weird feeling because it was like, here I was in this massive band. What am I going to do next? So I dove pretty head deep into like producing. I started producing more stuff, worked with Sindog from Cypress Hill, did a lot of that. Got into doing some film scores. And I sort of put bands behind me. I thought, well, I'm going to segue into like doing different stuff. I don't know. Let's just see what happens. And that's kind of been my life. It's just been, what's next? I don't know.
But then Velvet Revolver happened. So talk to me.
Well, I got back with the Cult though again before that. So I remember around 1998, I think it was. What year did Buck Cherry come out?
Yeah, that was in 98. Yep.
Steve Jones produced that first record, and he sent it. He said, hey, check this out, mate. I just produced this. I love the cocaine.
You know? Yeah, Lit Up. I'm All Lit Up Again. That was a big first thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought it had, a cult flavor to it because Jonesy was there. And I remember calling Billy Duffy, and Ian and Billy had broken up. And I said, Billy, I think there's a bit of a rock flavor coming back because there was a lull there for a minute. There was all the number bands that came out. I call them the Blink 182s and the Sum 41s and the, all that stuff. I don't want to call it new metal. It was that number bands came out, and there was sort of there wasn't a lot of rock. It was new metal. There was, the number bands, and I called Billy and I go, there's a bit of a rock thing happening in this band. I just saw this band, Buck Cherry. I think we could do something and we might get an attention. So Duffy flew out from England and stayed at my house with me. And then we booked a gig at the Viper Room, and Ian came down and we did a set. And we go, okay, let's book a tour. So we booked a tour. We got Martijn Lenoble from Pornos for Pyros on bass.
Yeah.
And we went out, we toured across the United States with no record deal, just played the catalog, sold out everywhere. We did 7 or 8 nights at the House of Blues, and we renamed it the House of Cult.
Yeah.
And then we got 3 record offers. Tom Zutat, Tom Wally at Warner's, and then we signed with Jason Flom, my old friend. And I said to him, you can't fire me, I'm a member.
Yeah.
So we signed a Lava and we made a record for Atlantic called Beyond Good and Evil.
Yeah.
So I was back in the Cult. We went back out, toured that record. And then the band split after that. I left. About 2 years went by before the Velvet Revolver thing happened. And that happened by accident too. My old pal Randy Castillo had passed away, Ozzy Osbourne's drummer. Phil Suzan played with Ozzy, calls, says, Matt, let's do a concert. Let's put something on for Randy. I said, yeah, let's do that. Let's get a headliner. Who can we get? Remember, we called Ozzy. Ozzy couldn't do it. Called Motley Crue, because Randy had gone on to play drums with Motley Crue, took Tommy's place.
Yeah.
We He died of cancer at a very young age, early 50s.
It was really sad.
But we wanted to pay tribute to him because he was such a badass dude. Did you ever meet Randy Castile?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Randy was really cool.
He was just epic.
Nice guy, man. Yeah.
And so I go, well, what if I get Slash and Duff? And we get up on stage. Because we haven't played together in like, I don't even know how long. And well, who are we going to get to sing? Slash goes, let's get that guy from Buck Cherry. I go, let me call Steven Tyler. We got Steven, Josh from Buck Cherry, and guys from Cypress Hill came. We did a kind of a rap version of Paradise City.
Yeah.
And the next day we had a band. Duff and Slash called and they're like, Matt, let's do this. And I go, okay, what are we doing? Well, let's rehearse. Let's find a singer. So we worked a little bit with Josh, but then we moved on and ended up finding Scott, and that became Velvet Revolver.
You know, and that was, I remember that period. You know, I remember being, giving you a call the day that Scott passed, and you were so kind to come on my show. And I remember saying to you, I was on Sirius XM at the time, and I remember I got a call. I was between airports flying to see my youngest daughter, and I got the call. I knew it Scott had died the night before, and he was very, really sad about that. And they said, well, you go on the air and do a tribute to Scott all day on Lithium, the channel that they, you know, that had the 90s channel. And you were so kind because I knew that was not an easy thing for you or any of the guys. And you agreed to come on the air with me, which was a very emotional moment.
I remember us doing that because, you know, obviously the band had split at that point. You know, we'd broken up and when we all got back together, our big thing was we can't do this if we're going to be loaded and everyone's fucked up.
Yeah.
So we made a pact to like everyone get clean. Let's get cleaned up. We were in really great shape. I went to the gym. I was ripped. I was like the skinniest I've ever been. And I was eating egg whites. I called Dave Navarro. What diet are you on?
You're like, egg whites, look like you, man.
He's like, egg whites and chicken breast. I'm like, that's it? He's like, yeah. And I was like, man, I was already in my 40s. I'm like, let's see if we can just look like a great rock and roll band. Get our look together. Get our songs together. Get our songs together, number one. Get looking good. And Scott was looking lean and mean. I don't know what he was doing to look like that. But he is great. And he was in good form. He'd cleaned up. We worked with him on it. We all did. And we kind of looked at it like the Aerosmith model. You know, if we're going to continue to play rock and roll, we can't go out there like 20-year-old kids. We can't be out there every night getting fucked up playing rock. We can't. We're older guys. We got to get our shit together. We all got it together, man, and we were on fire. And I remember we were all nervous because it's the first time we'd ever gone out on the road clean like that and sober, you know?
Yeah, when you were coming out for Contraband, 2004. Right, 2005.
You look back on him, fucking. We were like, and when we started getting, you know, the first album went triple platinum, and we got 3 Grammy nominations and won a Grammy, and got a lot of money, and the wheels came off the fucking wheels.
Yeah,
the wheels came off the machine. The train came off the tracks, and Bad Habits reappeared. You know, I started drinking again. Drugging, the whole thing, all of us.
Yeah.
And shit got fucked up. And typically people go, well, did you spend a lot of money doing drugs? I said, no, but I made a lot of bad decisions.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's like, usually how it goes, right?
Yeah. I made a lot of bad decisions. I did stupid shit. People give you drugs, man. Come on, forget it. You can get drugs. But if I had to do it all over again, I would be like, come on, you guys, man. We're not going to get this opportunity again. This is it for us. And we imploded. Second record, I like the second record. I think it's a good record.
Libertad, yeah.
But it didn't have the angst of the first record. The first record had a youthful thing because we were hungry. We were like, we meant it. I think we meant it on the second record musically.
Yeah.
But you didn't have that fairy dust of angst.
Yeah, it was there because you guys were proving yourselves again on the first record. And it was one of those things.
You felt it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And typically when you hear that on a lot of bands, early records, even though we were older guys, typically the first couple of records are always the best records.
Yeah.
You know, the Aerosmith, Toys in the Attic, Rocks. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Okay. So when the band broke up, you know, and Scott passed, a lot of people were calling me to do the interviews, like Rolling Stone. I was like, no. I knew Slash wasn't going to say anything. I knew Duff wouldn't. And then you called. I'm going to do it with you, Matt, because you know the history of rock and roll, and you've been there, and we were friends. And I had my differences with Scott, right? And everyone knows we were like, we fought like brothers. But really what I wanted for Scott was the best for Scott. Scott was so fucking great.
Yeah.
You just wanted him to realize how great he really was. You wanted to shake him and go, Scott, you're great. And he would put off the air of like, he was the epitome of a rock star. I mean, he'd walk on stage and go, fuck, there he is. Yeah. There's the front man. They just don't fucking make him like that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, Scott was an incredible frontman. He's one of the greats. When he was having a rough day, you know, that was the thing that was crazy.
Didn't matter.
If he was firing on 30%, he still had swagger. That was the thing I noticed.
Oh, yeah. When he stepped into Velvet Revolver, we were a band. You know, that was our biggest dilemma. How do we find the right singer? Obviously, he was from STP and there's a documentary called The Rise of Velvet Revolver, and I remember Duff says, oh, Scott Weiland's available. And I go, why is that? He goes, well, STP fired him. I go, why did he get fired?
Yeah.
You know? And then I remember thinking, is that the right guy? But then when he walked in and sang, I'm like, yep, there's the guy. It's going to be fucking dangerous. It's not going to be, I'm going to be a walk in the park. But no great rock and roll singer is a walk in the park. It's not that way.
Yeah.
And I've said this a million times. If you want the easy peasy guy, he ain't going to give you the show you want.
Yeah. You've had three incredible frontmen with Ian Astbury, Axl, of course, and Scott. I mean, all three of those guys, right? I mean,
I've worked with Alice Cooper, right? Alice Cooper is one of the greatest frontman.
Oh, I agree. I mean, he's one of my heroes.
Now he's the guy that shows up to rehearsal on time. He's on stage exactly on time. He does everything. But that wasn't always the story with Alice Cooper. Watch the documentary. Read his book.
You know, it's amazing. I mean, you know, he's like, been...
That guy went through hell and high water. And he came to a point in his life where he realized, if I don't get my shit together, I'm probably going to die, number one.
Yeah.
So he cleaned up. I think he's been sober 30 years.
Almost 40, I think.
Is it?
Or not. Yeah. Because remember when he made that From the Inside album, and he had come through that. I think
He posted a thing on Instagram the other day of him on the Tom Snyder Show. Check it out. He looks emaciated. He was so high on crack and everything else.
Yeah. So I think it's more like 40 years.
My point is, once you get to a certain point in your life and you haven't died – in the rock and roll business, you know. And then there's other guys like Lemmy. I remember playing with Lemmy. We were on stage on time. Everybody was on. Lemmy drank. You know, he was a drinker. But he'd sip his drink all day. He had to be sipping a Jack and Coke. He wasn't downing them. You know, he wasn't like us, you know. I'm like, wow, how does he do that? He's like, it's just kind of an even buzz.
Some guys can do it, you know. I couldn't, that's for sure. I mean, you know. So, but the good news is,
we're in good space for us guys.
Yeah, we are. I said full tilt boogie, which is why
it's either off or on for me. Like for me, it's like,
yeah,
you know, and it's. I guess that's a personality in us too. It's like we feel like responsible in some way. It's like okay. But I'm loving my life now and the way I feel. I'm drinking. Yeah. I'm drinking Topo Chico.
Oh, that's great. That's great sparkling water. Gives that's amazing. I love it.
Gives you a little bit of a kick in a different way.
Yeah, it does. You know, it's been great being in recovery and just, you know, I just feel better, man. You know, I do things to stay healthier. You know what I mean? What we do is, and also we're dads. You know what I mean? Like, and I want to be around for my daughters.
Well, look, I would never, I mean, I grew up in the 60s, you know, and everyone drank. I remember my parents smoking in the house, smoking in the car. You know, there was no seatbelts. You know, it was like kids. There was alcohol everywhere, and I grew up in that environment. And it seemed apropos of what to do. And there's certain generations that come up, especially 50s and the 60s, and that's the way you were brought up. You were brought, and especially when you were brought up through rock and roll. And there's that other element that comes into play. It's a little bit of peer pressure. There's a lot of drugs and drinking going on. It's just one big celebration. For me, it's like, this is just a different phase of my life. I have a girl, a little baby girl. I'm like, I quit smoking the day my wife said she broke water.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I have smoking cigars like a sieve because I'm off all the hard shit, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm going to quit because I'm not blowing tobacco and toxic bullshit on my kid's head when I want to kiss her.
Yeah.
So I quit. It was fucking hard. Quitting smoking? Oh.
No, I yeah.
Did you ever smoke, Matt?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But not until I was older. So it's one of those things where.
Are you still smoking?
I hate to admit it, but yes, I still smoke. I do. And I said, I'm getting closer to 2 years sober. And I said, I'm going to try and give up smoking on the day I hit 2 years without a drink.
Well, take one step at a time. I smoked cigars for about 5 years straight.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, for number one, I want to live longer for my baby because she's 9 months. I'm 61.
Yeah.
Number two, I don't want to have any of that toxic stuff around her. And I just want to be totally clear for my kid. And I can only say that at this point in my life at 61 years old. I don't know if I could have done that back when I was frolicking around with rock and roll bands.
Yeah.
And I saw friends of mine struggle with it. You know, friends of mine that had kids at home on the road. And many guys got divorced, you know, over drugs and drinking and fraternizing or whatever.
Yeah.
So I never wanted to have a family till I knew I was completely of sound mind and body. You know,
I think that's great.
I need to be the best possible because in the book you'll read. I mean, I didn't grow up in the best upbringing. I just always sort of, I never was feeling like the family unit was never really strong in my upbringing. And now I have my own family and it's fucking cool because, you know, and you know, as a guy that works on, you know, making himself a better person. That's a fucking huge struggle internally, you know, with guys like us.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we, behind all of this stuff that we go through with alcoholism and everything else, you know, there's feelings of unworthiness, you know. I'm not worth it. And this isn't something I should have. And it's like, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. You're very conflicted.
People think, look at a guy like me and like, how could you be that way? Well, read the book. The beginning of the book tells a story and it's sort of, but at the same time, the gratitude of what you and me have been able to do in our lives, what we've been able to achieve and the people we've been able to rub elbows with. And if you stay in that focus and you go, well, all that shit, it's like a Tony Robbins thing. Maybe who I am. Regardless, if you had a bad upbringing, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I can't say I had a bad upbringing. I was fed. I was housed. All that kind of stuff. But it just never felt right for me. So I took that energy maybe possibly some resentment, and it drove me to my success. And I hear that story over and over again. And sometimes when kids are grow up in a perfect environment, they come out really bad.
Yeah.
So you never can. I've seen that happen many times.
I think the great thing is that the success in it is striving to be better and working on ourselves personally. You know what I mean? And for some people that's, it could be recovery or 12-step program. And for others, it could be spiritual completely, whatever that happens to be, just trying to be a better person all the way around and have a spiritual direction.
I'm very spiritual in that regard. You know, and I've said this in the press. I've said I'm very faith-driven. And my wife is very, very spiritual. My wife comes from Oklahoma. She wakes up every morning. She reads the Bible. She's very, you know, God is like taking care of it all. And, you know, you can make that God whatever God you want it to be. And people say, I don't believe in God. Well, you got to believe in something.
Yeah.
What's the alternative?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, it's like, where do you go when this is all over? Well, I'd like to know that I want to go to a really cool place with lots of flowers on a fluffy cloud. You know, I prefer that. Like some dark doom and gloom. It's the dirt. No, I like the fluffy cloud idea. That sounds bitchin'.
Yeah.
I'm in entertainment. I like the video.
Absolutely.
You know, I want to go see my old friends and my dogs and shit like that. You know?
Yep.
And when you go to a service of somebody moving on to the afterlife, I prefer that approach when there is the afterlife. And I believe we are our souls and our souls connect and we walk in each other's paths for a reason. And we all learn from each other. And that's where I'm at now. I'm just that guy.
The group consciousness.
If I'm having a bad day and I'm starting to get on what we call the pity pot, or I'm like, oh shit, man, like boo boo boo. I'll turn a corner and there'll be a handicapped person walking across the street 9 times out of 10, or somebody that's having a really hard time in life. And I'm like, Matt, you're such an asshole. Get back to like being grateful, like now.
Because gratitude is everything. It really makes such a difference.
I don't care who you are. I don't care how much money you got or what you achieved in your life, or it's like, well, what do you have now? What's making you happy? Your family? It's not money. It's never going to be money. Money's not going to matter. You know, you got to have enough money to pay the rent and all that stuff. But for me, as soon as I became that focused on believing that everything is going to be taken care of, that's when everything changed for me. And like, I live in the desert. I don't have a band. I don't know what's going on. I got a call from my agent. She's like, I might have a gig. I'm like, okay, great. You know?
Yeah.
And I think so many people live in the fear of financial insecurity.
Yeah.
So as soon as you say the word fear, there's absolutely no faith in that equation. You're just putting yourself into a rabbit hole.
That's right.
It's dark. And it's the only thing you can do is just have hope and faith. That's it. And with the way the world's going and all this shit that's going on, man, we got through a really hard time. Now the world is at war with Ukraine and Russia. We just give them hope and hope that the outcome. And we send that vibration.
Yeah.
Right? And we do what we can.
That's it, man. It's absolutely true. And I just appreciate that you're coming on here and talking about everything that, And come up with that message of strength and hope, man, is the most important thing.
Well, it's not who I was. If I would have come on here 20 years ago, you and me would have been talking about, you know.
We've been in the same room with insanity to you and I over the years, right? We've been through it like in wild times. I mean, we definitely
have. Well, it's very weird when you write a book because you go through your life and you're like, man, I've changed a lot.
Yeah.
There's a part of me where it's like, whoa, oh my God, how could I have acted that way? Or why did I, but you're a kid, you're learning. It's all learning curve. And I used to say all the time when I would go on these wild adventures, I used to say, well, it'll be great for a book.
Yeah. And now you have the book. I'm excited it'll be coming out soon. I got to tell you that.
Well, yeah, it's been a little bit, the pandemic shut it down. And then when I had my baby girl, I just looked at it and I went, I'm just going to take one last peek at it and put it out.
Yeah, so it'll be out soon. But we're excited about it. I know everybody else is really pumped about it. That last chapter is about a lot of things you just talked about, how you came full circle. The last chapter in the book is The Other Side of the Grass, which is really cool. So, and you covered a lot of that. And I'm going to tell you how much I appreciate it. And I love your story, Matt, because you're just such a positive, great guy. And you've been there for me. I mean, when I was struggling, man, you've been there for me in a big way.
Well, I'm always here for you, Matt, because, we're the Matts.
Yes, we are. Absolutely. Yeah. I see it, man. We've been through everything,
And we love you, Matt. Years. I mean, the world loves you, Matt. The world loves you. The world loves your voice on the radio, through the airwaves. Your knowledge is so deep. I mean, I always called you the encyclopedia of rock and roll. Thank you, Matt.
I appreciate that, man. That's really kind of you.
And that's true. I mean, sometimes I think a lot of us, if there's like that empty feeling of like, I'm not feeling love today. But if you can go out, because a lot of times we're the kind of people that if we have an enemy or someone's trying to hurt us, we tend to focus on the negative. But there's a fucking shitload more people that love you than that don't like you, Matt. And there's people that don't like me out there. I know there is. There's a lot of them, but I don't want their energy. I want the people that love me energy.
Yeah.
The rest of it's like, they don't like me. That's fine. But yeah. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah. And that's where, and I appreciate that, man. I really got to say that to you. And that's where I'm at too, because, there's always going to be those people they call energy vampires. And there's going to be people that are, sometimes I think people listening would also agree with this, and need to know is that sometimes it's not really even about you. It's about somebody else. It's about the person that doesn't like you. It's what's going on inside them. The important thing is to stay focused on positivity and people in your life that you love, and that's the most important thing. And doing as much of what you love in your life as you can and being grateful for it. And that's what it's all about. It really is. And that's how I'm able to stay on the straight and narrow. And I'm grateful to be here.
Well, I want you to come out to the desert. I'm going to give you that ride in my 62 Galaxy.
I can't wait for that. Do you have an 8-track player in there so we can rock?
No, I got an AM radio.
AM radio would be cool. That's so great.
Got two stations.
Yeah.
One of them plays like Peggy Lee, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis.
And that's cool because I like that old rock pack stuff. That'll be fun too.
That's one station that works, and the other station that works is like 70s rock, 60s.
That I really want to hear. I love that.
Yeah, stuff. And then I'm building a new recording studio called Good Noise. It's going to be really exciting. So I'm going to do some streaming from there, and I want you to. We should do something cool together out here. I'm going to have that ready in May.
I'll come out and we'll do something because we always talked about doing the two mats. We've been talking about that for years.
I'm going to have a sick setup. I got my old recording studio, Drac, from Hollywood. It's moving out here. So
yeah, that's phenomenal. I'm excited. We're doing it, Matt. I'm going to come out there. We should ride bikes and we should take your
car. I got four bikes in the garage.
And I'm in because I love bike riding, man. That's a great feeling of freedom. It really is. And I rented a bike out there at one of the resorts in Palm Springs during this radio convention called the Sunset Sessions, which is actually the last place I saw Scott alive, back and brought him on stage. But I will say, when people were going crazy and not getting up early, I did get up the one day and rented a bicycle and rode that path that you're talking about. And I loved doing it.
You rode the bike trail.
Cool. Yeah, it was great freedom. It was really cool. Matt, thanks so much for doing this, and we'll catch up soon. But man, much love to you, my brother.
Yeah, this was awesome. Man, I love you, brother. Yeah, my absolutely. Rock and roll brother.
Yeah, you are absolutely. I love you, brother, man. And we'll be talking soon. So thanks for doing the show. It was great, man.
Stay close.
You got it, Matt. Thank you.
Anytime.
If you or someone you know is struggling with alcoholism or addiction, Music Cares operates a mental health and addiction recovery program that understands the challenges music professionals face, no matter where they are in their career. Learn more, including if you're eligible, at musiccares.org. That's musiccares.org.
Sound, sobriety, and success with Matt Pinfield. Produced by Jake Urbanek. Engineered by Darren Silva. Jerry Onzaldo, booking. Bill Royal, research. Susan Aksu, marketing production assistant. And Laura Keeney, marketing. Sound, sobriety, and success is a Bennstown McVeigh podcast production.